welcome to The Last Thing I Saw, and probably the last episode of the Sundance Film Festival series I've been puttering about doing. Actually, not much puttering. I am seated for these podcasts. I want you to know that. Very happy to go out with a grand finale with the stalwart, Mr. Eric Hines of the Museum of the Moving Image. Hello, Eric.
Hello, Nick. How are you?
I'm fine. Good. I'm good.
Good.
Vaguely wondering if people are still going to be able to see some of the movies that we see, that we are going to talk about, but yeah. I think there's a good chance for most or all of them.
Well, I mean, to that question, I mean, I think it's actually worth spending a moment on that because you and I aren't here to talk about the business, thankfully, but certainly the ability for people to see these films. You know, we certainly want people to see the films. I know a lot of, you often talk about films that are coming to theaters, and often, you know, the idea of seeing things in festivals is the idea they're going to be disseminated and make their way around the world afterwards. But, you know, the word out of the festival is that sales are slow, and therefore it does feel a little bit scary in terms of usually a festival like Sundance, if you play there, you're going to get out there. You're going to get seen. You're going to get picked up, or you're going to be playing at other festivals. And I'm sure one way or another, that's probably what's going to happen, but it might actually be a little bit longer than normal because people seem to be really waiting for the other shoe to drop in a good way, you know, waiting for the shoe of sales to drop so that people can start figuring out what their calendar is going to be for showing these movies. So hopefully, folks will be able to see these films sooner rather than later, although it quite possibly could be the latter.
Yeah, and it's always funny, although I don't know if this happens as much with Sundance, it's more of a Cannes thing, I guess, where it's like a whole year before the movie finally comes to theaters, and that's always strikes me as a bit cruel for people who have been reading or hearing about it. It's like,
Well, the momentum, you know, like what value is momentum? And I'm sure the distributors know how much value that has or when it matters and when it doesn't. But I mean, there's Sundance is a big festival. A lot of people are seeing these films now and writing about them. So it wouldn't be a terrible time to keep that momentum going.
Yeah. Well, the fun thing about this virtual setup is that I know both of us were catching up on a fair number of titles on the weekend, the last weekend, which also, you know, you do when you're in person there, but you can binge even more with the online. So maybe we could start with a couple of pairings or maybe one pairing. I think we have a couple that go together. Maybe one interesting one could be an award winner. Actually, I think a double award winner, actually. Kokomo City, which I think we both saw.
Kokomo City is a first feature, I believe, by Dee Smith, who is a kind of multi-hyphenate songwriter, producer, filmmaker, video artist. Yeah, this is their first feature, and Dee Smith is a trans artist, and this is the subject of Kokomo City are trans people who have worked the streets, as it were, in both New York and Georgia as sex workers. And it has a pretty bracing, unguarded, you know, very strong, you know, wouldn't be wrong to say maybe music video aesthetic in terms of very stylized black and white approach, but also kind of really toggles between straight up interviews and kind of, you know, sequences that sort of illustrate a little more sort of fever dream illustrations of some of the stories that are being told. And anyway, what the stories are basically life on the streets, what the experiences are, what the kind of reality of it is. And, you know, it's really mostly made up. The substance of the film are these conversations, are these monologues really of what it's like. And it comes on, it's pretty fast and furious. Like these stories keep coming, and that's sort of the outlines of it.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you would add or what your first thoughts of it are.
It's interesting because I think you might come to this documentary like expecting people in the documentary to be kind of informants, you know, on something you're not familiar with. But it's interesting that they are basically, they have the dual roles of being informants, but also like analysts of everything.
Totally.
And commentators. And I think one thing I really like is how they embrace that role and how the film really lets us listen to pretty, you know, sharp and justifiably cutting commentary, not just about negotiating the world as a trans person, but also the vantage point that gives you, you know, on I'm not saying like a judgmental way, but just like hypocrisies and, you know, different sides of people's identity that they come across. So that was really kind of interesting to me. And
yeah.
I mean, I have to say, like, the posture of a lot of documentaries that might be on this subject from like 20, 25 years ago would be so very, very different.
Oh, sure.
I don't know if any of that makes sense.
No, of course. It's very, very different. But I also feel like what's going on in this film is very different than you might find in something that has like a pretty definitive political place that it's coming from and where it's intended. You know, I feel like the discourse in this is really not the same place as maybe academic discourse might be or online discourse. You know, where they're coming from is just whatever. Like there's stuff in here that's get discussed and presented that would not necessarily align with, you know, and I'm not saying this in a kind of a reactionary way, you know, like what is the sort of correct terminology or correct way of talking about the trans experience. This film doesn't seem to be necessarily coming from there either. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, no, I think that's so, so good to point out, actually, because you're not, I don't think the movie is presented as this is the right way that we should be talking about,
right.
Talking about these things, you know, and
right.
Yeah, you're getting wide swaths of experience.
Yeah, and they're sex workers who, in a sense, have to be open to where other people are coming from. So whatever they might feel, or in general, they might feel things stand in terms of identity. You know, if a quote unquote straight guy comes around and wants things a certain way and thinks of things a certain way, that's a kind of exchange they have to be ready for, you know, and they talk about that a lot, you know, in terms of like what those dynamics are, what they represent to other people, how they use that to their own advantage, how they use that for profit, how they protect themselves. Like it's a real spectrum of experience that they're saying here. A lot of it is really brutal. A lot of it's very, very funny. And it really does work as a comedy, which is pretty outrageous, but a satisfying one, because you're basically, we're not scrutinizing these people. These people are sort of letting us in what their experiences are, and they're great storytellers, just, in, you know, like just fantastic, you know, communicators of their own experiences, that I feel like you're just kind of privy to these buoyant, gallows, dark comedic experiences.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just fascinating because they're in positions where they can't think of how things might or should or could be. It's literally like there's one story about noticing a John has a gun.
Right.
I almost don't want to spoil it, but they have to react. It's not that the gun is immediately brandished at all, but they have to react as if that's what's about to happen. There's just no other choice, you know, because and I don't know. It's just a very stark and eye-opening view of things.
I think that's the first scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a real audience film. Like, I can just really see people loving the hell out of watching this in a movie theater.
Yeah.
And yeah, and like I said, it's funny and outrageous, but also like it's an inclusive experience because you're brought in to their world.
Yeah. I mean, funny and sobering all the time at the same time. And the only thing I was going to say is that consequently, with the forthrightness and just candor of it, I was totally baffled by a couple of the music choices that happen. And I'm not talking about like a particular song, but there are a few interviews where they're using the kind of like filler music you have like in a reality show, where if someone is talking about something silly that happened to them, you have like kind of goofy music playing in the background.
Uh-huh.
And it was so jarring and bizarre. What? Why would you put such just like off the shelf feeling like superficial music?
I took it as kind of like a real, to me, like that seemed like a real choice in terms of an aesthetic. Maybe I'm giving it too much credit. But yeah, to me, it just played as, yeah, there's the references I think that you're drawing from, which aren't wrong. But maybe that's just sort of like a flavor that it wanted in there,
mm-hmm.
You know, rather than to kind of take it too seriously or to amplify in an expected way, or to sort of indicate an emotional thing.
No, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. And yeah, it's not like a flaw in the film. It was just sort of puzzling me whenever it happened. One other thing, though, they do have a couple of people who are talking, who are, I guess, from the John side of things.
Right.
I mean, I couldn't tell the movie's tone toward them in a way.
I would say that the John element is interesting because they really do seem to come up when they don't really come into sort of to contradict the sex workers. It's more to kind of, in a sense, back up what they're saying about certain clientele, you know. That's what I recall of them chiming in. It's less about like they're there to provide a different point of view on what the sex workers are describing, and more just like, yeah, you know, the truth is this or truth is that. And, you know, I know guys who pretend that they don't like this, but of course they like this, you know, that sort of thing, which was helpful. If also, yeah, exactly where do you place them in the spectrum of all this is hard to tell. But anyway, you brought up The Stroll.
Yeah, The Stroll, which I have not seen. So tell me about The Stroll.
Yeah, sure. So The Stroll is a little bit more of a traditional documentary. It's in this sense co-directed by a former sex worker in the space where it is set, which is what's called as The Stroll in the West Village adjoining the Hudson River in New York, as being the kind of, you know, meatpacking district, you know, West Village area, where you know, there's a, you know, vibrant scene for a very long time until gentrification over the last 30 years, especially in the last 25 years, really sort of made that space less of their own, less of a claimed space for gay and trans community. But it's sort of like recounting those years, recounting what it was like to be sex workers in that area, but also just to be part of a community in that area. But Kristen Lovell is the co-director and is a subject to some degree. Zachary Drucker is the other co-director. And it's produced by Matt Wolff, renowned documentary filmmaker who often works and archival material. Yeah, so this is like, there's sort of like a first-person autobiographical element from Kristen Lovell's point of view, as well as just a lot of interviews between her and other folks who lived and worked in that space. And it sort of toggles between tough stories, difficult stories, living through difficult times, AIDS crisis, of course, preceding the gentrification issue, but also, you know, a wistfulness and a sense of loss for that community. And so many died from HIV AIDS during that time, and then also just lost track of one another. So this film kind of brings back the surviving members of the community, and they kind of revisit these spaces in the meatpacking district and along the Hudson, and, you know, just tries to like tell that story and tell that story from the inside, and kind of repossess these memories and repossess this space. It's not the most like a formally ambitious film in the world, but it is, you know, really loaded with, you know, valuable material and testimony.
Yeah, which is, you know, every day more valuable. I mean, obviously for the people involved, but, you know, also for being a part of New York history, these things are sort of constantly being erased and yeah, forgotten. So I like what you're saying about repossessing the spaces.
And there's some beautiful scenes where that's really what they're doing. You know, they're kind of talking to some people who really don't know even what used to be there. You know, that's how much it's been erased. Mm. And also kind of, yeah, just sort of planting themselves in these same spots again. You know, quite a bit of talk about the High Line and how much that changed that space, and it couldn't be more different as a result. Mm. But yeah, no, I mean, in terms of a vanishing New York, you know, you and I are not young, but we're certainly not the old guard, and to realize how much things have changed within the lifetime of the people who came before us, it's pretty harrowing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And also not without its humor, not without some incredible stories told and illustrated as well. Yeah, it's also, it feels like New York too. You know, it feels like a piece that can travel, that is somewhat accessible from outside the community, but also feels like it's got the right personality, you know, and has the right feeling about gentrification, a pretty strong point of view on law enforcement, and cynicism regarding that. It's nice that this film came from the right place, and that I think it for the most part works and probably will be relatively widely seen, which is great.
Yeah, no, that's great. And yeah, that's something I'm going to have to catch up with. Yeah, so that's The Stroll alongside Kokomo City. I wanted to ask about a fiction film that you saw, which I did not, but I wanted to get to. And I think, you know, the title alone was intriguing just because it's a term that comes up in Nanny.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
From last fall. And that's Mami Wata. What can you say about Mami Wata?
So Mami Wata was in the World Narrative Competition and actually won Best Cinematography, and justly so. It's a really distinctive gorgeous looking film. But Mamiwata is, yeah, it's the West African folklore of, you know, Mamiwata being kind of like a goddess of sorts of the sea. And it's a village of Iyi, I think it's a fictional village of Iyi, where, you know, that's sort of the religion. And there's a healer named Mama Efe, who is the conduit between Mamiwata and the people. And she has two daughters, one an actual daughter and one kind of adopted daughter. And one is sort of loyal to Mama Efe, which is the adopted daughter, and the one who is sort of meant to be takes over as the healer after Mama Efe passes, is very much resistant and just really doesn't buy it as a faith. So there's sort of film starts with a bit of a rift there. And then what happens over the course of the film is that the community starts getting a little impatient with the kind of lack of success in Mama Efe to save the population. Children are dying. And there's kind of unrest about it's not working anymore. She's not actually taking care of the population. And within that, you know, in rushes, both people within the town as well as from out of the town who are looking for westernization, who are actually looking for medical doctors, who are looking for plumbing and lights and, you know, modern comforts and technology. And there's that kind of, sort of an age old conflict between the two, and then the two young women left to be the ones who either take over or fight or acquiesce. And so there's, you know, it's a very sort of, it's a fable, and it works well as a fable. As a film, it's shot in very inky, high contrast black and white, and has a bit of a flat square approach. So there's something early cinema about it. It also kind of harkens to 20th century African cinema of some sorts. It also just, you know, could easily be a woodcut. You know, it has that kind of strength, some vivid black and white visuals. And there's something kind of overtly wooden a bit about performances and some dialogue that I think is very knowing. And not only a sort of early cinema, but there's even something a little bit of 1980s independent film about this too. You know, there's like a Hal Hartley quality to some of this, which, you know, I have no idea if that's part of what the influence is here for the filmmaking team, but there seems to be a real kind of bringing together of some very disparate influences in terms of tone and visuals, and really clearly nothing else like it at the festival. And there won't be too many films like it this coming year. So I was very excited by it and was pretty entranced by it visually. And the filmmaker is a CJ Fiery Obasi. I believe his brother is the producer of the film, and there's some, you know, really impressive performances as well. Like, it's certainly not going to be for everyone. It's certainly going to try some patience because it is just not the most contemporary tones or approaches to filmmaking. But to me, I was that much more impressed. And it even made me think of Guy Madden at times, the kind of sort of self-consciously anti-contemporary, you know, or sort of anachronistic approach. It seems to really sort of reveling in that while also not living entirely within that. You know, it's, it doesn't want you to think that it was made in 1935, you know, it's clearly made now, but it's adopting some of that, some of the composition, aesthetic and tone of that work.
I guess every year has a certain number of films shot in black and white, but it does seem that there are a number of striking ones this year, I guess, including, well, we were just talking about Kokomo City.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the kind of lo-fi of this movie Divinity,
yeah,
which is this kind of B thriller that I don't know that a lot of people ended up seeing, that I guess was, yeah, it was like a slam dance title right in Sundance, more or less.
And Fremont.
Also, yeah, almost an 80s slice of yeah, black and white. And
yeah.
So that's Mamiwata. And I mean, a movie that I saw that I think I'm not sure that you caught up with yet, which is Drift.
I was curious about Drift, yeah.
Yeah, and there were a couple like notably ravey sort of advanced word things about it before the festival. And I, you know, you never know where that's coming from exactly. But I was obviously interested just on the strength of the actress in it. And Drift, it's directed by Anthony Chen, who directed Ilo Ilo. It's the main movie I know. I know there's also Wet Season. I haven't seen that. And Drift is a story where Erivo plays a refugee, basically, from Liberia. although it's strange to talk about it from the start like that, because really the way the movie unfolds is that you don't really know where she is, and where she is Greece on the coast, and basically kind of a tourism spot, you know, a lot of ruins, and she's just kind of laying low there, but you don't know really know how she got there, what she's doing. Is she doing okay? And what's going to happen next? And I would have to say it's really a lot to do with Erivo's performance. It's a portrait of trauma. And, you know, what you would say, like PTSD. And I have not seen something as strong along those lines in a long time. I think she kind of finds a novel way of performing that and conveying that. But yeah, I mean, what the movie does, what Anthony Chen does, the director, is with flashbacks kind of, you know, shows how she got there. And it starts with her being in a government minister's family, I think, is what her father does. She lives on a compound with her sister and armed guards, because there's clearly some sort of civil war that's happening. And you have this kind of horrifying progression, just little by little, of how their bubble is just about to be broken into by child soldiers, actually. And those sequences are horrifying. I mean, just because of the menace involved and also what you know will happen. And the movie is very sort of judicious in how it tells that that story in the flashback. So you have that being filled in. And meanwhile, in Greece, in the present, she is just trying to hold it together. All the compositions kind of play up her solitude and against this location that, you know, that where tourists are coming to watch history that's frozen for, you know, their delectation, you know, statues of gods and goddesses and whatnot. And that's another third of the movie, is that she befriends, or a tour guide befriends her, played by Alia Shawkat.
Sure.
So they kind of develop a relationship, and you can tell that the tour guide is sort of slowly, not initially at all, but then slowly figuring out that something's kind of going on, something's awry. So that's a, you know, an interesting relationship to watch. Bit challenging because these two actors have such different presences and performance styles. And that's not taking away from what Shawkat's doing. It's just that Erivo, I feel like, is building something from the ground up, something like really at once, like very granular, but also a little theatrical, but then back to granular. I don't even know how to describe it, but like there's one kind of scene where she has to describe what happens to her. And she like uses stuttering in this way that just very keyed into like how language is linked to trauma. Anyway, I was really moved by it and really impressed by what she did. But I can see that it's a movie that, I mean, it's not exactly a movie you walk out skipping, you know, seeing. And it's also a movie that is kind of necessarily static. Not entirely, but just because she really is, you know, stuck. She's really kind of in shock. She's shell-shocked.
Yeah.
And is a person of color without money, living in ruins, or, you know, and obviously vulnerable to be taken advantage of. So yeah, that's Drift, which is almost a innocuously abstract title to give this movie. But yeah, I was impressed by it. And I mean, I wondered, you know, why I didn't hear or read more about it. It's a pretty striking film for me. Okay. I don't know.
It's interesting you mentioned about the title. I, you know, in some ways, like, I feel like I've seen things not that long ago named this. I could be right or wrong, but for something that you've described that is so particular and has such definition, to have like a, as you said, like an abstract title doesn't seem quite right.
I think there's the Helena Whitman. Isn't that one of her, like, her films like 3 or 4 years ago? I think
yes, was called Yes, Drift. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. And I don't want to underplay like the friction that's going on in this relationship that the Shawkat and Erivo, just because I could see someone watching just and thinking that it's just not quite working. But again, like, that's part of the movie, is the clash between someone who is in one entirely different headspace to someone who's a tour guide and has kind of found a way to live. Anyway, I'm curious. I should maybe look around more and read what people have written about it. It was definitely one of the dramas that I liked more this year. Nice. And that brings us, I mean, I guess from one wartime experience to another, there are a couple of Ukraine documentaries.
Yeah.
That I know you've seen, and again, I'm bad. I have not seen them.
No, it's okay. No, but it's just, you know, I think it's good. We're going to finish up a full session here with us talking about films that, you know, the subjects of which we completely understand and relate to and live in our own experiences here, you know, from
that's yeah, right.
Everything here. We're fully entitled to say anything we want about these films and what they're about. But yes, the two Ukraine documentaries were 20 Days in Mariupol and Iron Butterflies, very different films. 20 Days in Mariupol is very much a work of reportage, but isn't disguising that, which I really appreciated about it. It's basically by an actual AP videographer or you know, freelance videographer who worked with the AP, Mislav Chernov. And a lot of what we were seeing during that siege of Mariupol last year in terms of video content came from him. He was, you know, sort of in the thick of it, in apartment buildings, in hospitals, on the streets, in hiding, embedded with the military. He was all over the place and often did not have access to cell phone. The city was really bombarded, and there just often wasn't Wi-Fi, there wasn't cell service. The hospitals themselves were working without electricity a lot of the time, just horrific things that were going on. And he basically goes through this, you know, 20 days. It's chronologically day by day. And what you see is whenever he's able to send his footage off to the news agencies, to his editor, they play basically the actual news coverage, the little clips that they use from what he sent along. You have seen that footage because he basically goes and spends 5 to 10 minutes on that day going through the day and what happened. And so you get the kind of, now, I wouldn't say raw footage, you have the edited, prolonged documentary version, and then you get the clips that showed up in the news, and it's narrated by him as well. I kind of really love that structure, you know, where, you know, there's no denying the position that he's in. He's not pretending he was there to shoot a documentary. He was there to capture footage of what was happening, but it kind of creates some dimensionality, and it also sort of puts him physically in that space. In a way that obviously the news clips wouldn't actually have done. And so you see the interactions he has with the subjects. One of the things that I'll never forget is that the doctors in certain moments basically saying, you must film this. You must film this. People must see what's happening. And he'll often point to, like, you know, somebody who's really in a bad way. And, you know, there may be an ethical question of whether or not that such things should be filmed. And he was like, you must film this. No one's going to believe you. This has to be shown. Also because there's a knowledge of the misinformation that Russia was perpetuating and always perpetuates. So, like, you know, in order to counteract that, the world must know this is actually happening. And a lot of that footage, if you remember, if anybody remembers any of the footage coming out of that moment of the war, of the attacks, probably the most famous image from that time is the hospital was bombed and people were carrying a pregnant woman out on a stretcher.
Yeah.
And he's the one who captured that footage. So he gives you pretty much the shape of that entire situation, you know, being stationed nearby and seeing a building go up in flames and seeing a bomb go off and then doing the kind of geographic measuring and realizing that that was the hospital. And then he goes over there and then he encounters the horrific scene there. So, I mean, obviously a very difficult film to watch, but, you know, I think that those interactions with those doctors is kind of like, it's the film in a nutshell. You know, you must see this. You absolutely just have to see this. You should not forget that this actually happened, and you shouldn't pretend, and you should not be, no one should think otherwise that this is what was actually happening. And obviously continues to happen there, you know, a year later.
Yeah.
So yeah, a very difficult watch, but you know, as one of these films, like you're privileged to be able to have that proof, and have that, you know, forever. And obviously the voiceover, as you can imagine, being a kind of first person account of this, is a very shell shocked, traumatized man, kind of recounting days that I'm sure he wishes he could forget forever.
Yeah, it's incredible that it seems like in some ways we're still not far along from, you know, when just the footage about what happens in a war is still not like top of mind somehow. I mean, but it feels like we're still shielded from that. You know, it's still
right. Just
background noise. I don't know.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And the longer it goes, the more like whatever, just it's another thing that you can't possibly carry that every day. You can't possibly keep up with that. So yeah, it becomes background noise. And yeah, it's important.
And so that was one, and then the other one.
Iron Butterflies is very different, and Iron Butterflies is a much more creative endeavor by the filmmaker Roman Ljubi, and he's part of a collective of artists, resistance artists in Ukraine that formed, I believe, 9 years ago. You know, when Ukraine was, in a sense, going through a civil war, certainly civil unrest, which led to it, the biggest break it had made from Russia. But it's centering on the downing of, you know, of the Malaysian airline in 2014, and gathers together both the documentary evidence, research into what actually happened, as well as the persistent misinformation coming from Russia about it. And it's sort of a video essay. It's also kind of a hybrid, somewhat fantastical film. There's some very dark humor in this. It sort of like kind of approaches the situation from all these different angles, you know, to kind of just, you know, as a memorial to what happened, but also as a, you know, in a sense to sort of work against what you and I were just describing in terms of maybe how it's sort of inevitable over the course of a year for us to start tuning out and maybe forget the details of what happened here. You know, the Iron Butterflies is basically there to say, do not let all this information and this bullshit sort of make you doubt that it was Russian missiles that downed this commercial flight and killed hundreds of people. So yeah, it's another bracing affair where it is going to do its as much as it can to show you the evidence, but also just, you know, is withering in terms of the way that it sort of very cleverly and in very sort of minimal strokes shows you like the lies coming from Russia and how they were using media and the news and, you know, their magazine shows, chat shows to instill doubt, if not outright lies, in terms of what happened. And the hybrid element is really that there are some dance sequences, which sounds like, what is that doing there? And I do, you know, it seems like in the response to this film was the thing that kind of rubbed people the wrong way. But I think when you're approaching a subject that's 9 years old and you're actually looking to find different ways of bringing it to life and to honoring the situation, something like, you know, dance as a way of kind of visiting certain scenes and sequences that wouldn't have been captured on camera was fine with me. It felt like an attempt. It felt like such an obvious approximation that can't come close to getting it right or capturing it, which is in a sense more responsible and maybe more emotionally evocative. Hmm. It's pretty sparing. There's like maybe three or four sequences like this where it's both kind of, you know, positing, you know, victims as dancers, Russian military as dancers, as well as Ukraine military. And I don't know, it's coming at things from a lot of different directions. And there's something about its willingness to kind of do a cubistic approach to something like this that I really appreciate it. I feel as there's no perfect way of doing it, but in some ways it actually felt quite right. Like there's something about this that harmonizes with the fragmentary approach to the way that that's remembered.
No, I mean, for some reason, just hearing about that, that sounds exactly right to try something like that, you know, I mean, but when you say dance, do you mean like a balletic sort of sequence or?
Yeah, balletic sequences, no, without dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it's a very clearly different, aesthetically different. I think they're all black and white. There's no attempt to kind of fool you into thinking that you're watching something that's a strict documentary when it comes to those sequences. Just something that's a little bit more expressive and transcendent. Yeah, not necessarily for the best, but transcending what's available in terms of telling the story.
For some reason, I'm flashing back to the still that was the first thing I ever saw of The Act of Killing.
Uh-huh.
This giant fish or something, or right. You know, I mean, right. With people kind of in a procession going towards it. Something you look at that and you're like, what is this movie about, you know, or how is this movie about what it's supposed to be about?
Yeah.
If this is the image I'm seeing. And to a certain extent, that kind of, whatever the word is, like alienation effect or estrangement from what you think it's going to be about is a useful thing. Although here, maybe it also just sounds like there's something about bodily emotion. And
I think that's it. Yeah. I think the bodily emotion, that's the one thing we're not really seeing here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not really seeing the bodies of those who were murdered. We're also not necessarily seeing the bodies of the perpetrators, you know. You know, we're seeing a lot of people showing up on scene to sift through the rubble and to visit it as a, you know, kind of funeral ground, but you're not really seeing the participants in a bodily fashion. There's also just, you know, not to lean into it too hard or kind of make too explicit what's implying, but I think taking a cubistic fragmentary approach, you know, has some resonance when their subject is an incident like this, you know, a tragedy like this, where you've got nothing but fragments to piece together, you know?
Sure. Yeah. No, usually that would just be like the black box or something.
Yeah.
Well, that's Iron Butterflies.
Well, what a way to finish. What a way to finish. Our
I know. Goodness.
I feel like I got to know one other film, just the name of something else that you would recommend that we haven't, that you never talked about.
Oh, okay. Well,
because otherwise.
Well, one movie that I did watch, and that was, I watched it even knowing that it was coming out this summer, is a horror movie, Talk to Me, which is from a couple of, I guess, YouTube artisans from Australia. And yeah, it's like, it's so funny that it's the most like straightforward, like seance premise, and you're letting, like bringing evil into the world. But it just has this steadfast growing menace throughout it. You know, you do feel creeped out. I did watch it, I think around midnight at home. I don't know if I would like it so much that I would watch it again in a theater, but I like the idea of doing that just because I would want to see a crowd react to it. So I did like that.
Sure.
Talk to Me, not to be confused with, with Almodovar's Talk to Her.
Talk to Her. And I'll say, I won't go into describing, but I think we decided that it would be better for us not to make fools of ourselves. But Deborah Stratman's Last Things, I really, really liked. And Deborah Stratman,
yes,
you know, working in a kind of mid-length mode, very experimental, but also, you know, very, also pretty fragmentary. That I think that's a film that probably will show up at some festivals near you. And I just recommend it highly before I say any more than that. Oh, and Against the Tide. Against the Tide is also a very strong documentary. So I'll leave it there.
Having seen Last Things, I'll second that. Just being in a very curious mind, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So Last Things will be the last
perfect
last film that we'll talk about, and yeah, until next time, Mr. Hines.
Well, it'll be a year till Sundance, but hopefully at a festival nearer to us we can do this again.
Indeed.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.